From Queens, New York, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Ricky Riccardi knows Louis Armstrong better than almost any person alive. He's got Armstrong's tapes, his records, his books.
This is Famous American Negroes by Langston Hughes, and it is inscribed especially for Louis Armstrong, with my admiration and high regard, Langston Hughes, April 3rd, 1954, in the most beautiful handwriting I've ever seen.
Riccardi directs research collections for the Louis Armstrong House Museum. As a child, he fell in love with the music of Armstrong's later years.
It was everything. It was like the entire human experience coming out of this guy. And I just embraced all of it.
Ricky Riccardi on the joys and sorrows of Louis Armstrong. After the break. Something should never happen to a trumpet. Never soak it in water. Never extract a mouthpiece with a pair of pliers or a hammer. And never, ever let this man's lips get anywhere near. But this is not just any man, and that's not just any trumpet.
My name is Ricky Riccardi. I'm director of research collections for the Louis Armstrong House Museum, author of What a Wonderful World, The Magic of Louis Armstrong's Later Years, Queens College professor teaching music of Louis Armstrong, CD producer for Universal and Sony and Mosaic Records. All Armstrong all the time.
Ricky Riccardi is one of the world's foremost experts on Louis Armstrong, and we are here at Queens College in New York to learn more about both men. Armstrong is endlessly interesting, and Riccardi is a self-taught maven who in 2009 won the immediate respect of fellow scholars and the caretakers of the Armstrong estate. Right now, he's kinda sorta trying to play the archive's 1958 Selmer trumpet, made in Paris, gold-plated, and with Louis Satchmo Armstrong engraved down the bell.
Ooh, that sounds good. Got nothing.
To be fair, Riccardi is a piano player, and while he may toot Armstrong's horn to music lovers around the world, he does not often blow one of Louis's horns in the confines of the archive. But along with the other titles that Riccardi claims, he's also a nice guy, and we asked him to throw on a pair of white protective gloves and give the old Selmer a whirl. At a moment like this, the only Armstrong song that comes to mind is the one called No Papa, No. Riccardi is way more comfortable when he's talking about Armstrong, who's been at the center of his life since middle school in Toms River, New Jersey. Riccardi was born in 1980, about 9 years after Armstrong died. As a youngster, Riccardi fell in love with Laurel and Hardy, the Three Stooges, Buster Keaton, and the Marx Brothers.
Hey, if you get near a song, play it. And I can't think of anything else. You know what I think? I think I went past it. Well, if you come around again, jump off. I once kept this up for 3 days. You wouldn't consider a hush money, would you?
That was my elementary school. I just fell in love with old culture, old comedies, old movies, old anything. And my parents supported it.
Yeah.
And the first music I loved was 1950s rock and roll and Chubby Checker and Elvis Presley and my grandparents listening to Frank Sinatra and all that. So then I got to the hellish middle school years where I had to learn just enough about hip-hop and alternative music not to get beat up. But meanwhile, in my spare time, I was listening to Ragtime and Eddie Cantor. I was going way back, way, way, way back.
My name is Maxie. I drive a taxi. I'm the happiest taxi driver in the town. I'll always sing a song as I drive along. You'll never ever see me wear a frown. But when my day is done, that's when it's really fun. I give the kids a ride around the square. I let them ride for free, but they have to promise me to wash their hands and brush their teeth and always comb their hair.
But the Big Bang was when I was 15 years old. I rented the movie The Glenn Miller Story with Jimmy Stewart, mostly because I was the only 15-year-old who was a big Jimmy Stewart fan. I don't really know so much about Glenn Miller, but and midway through the movie, Louis Armstrong comes in, and he does one song, Basin Street Blues, and I sat up at attention. I need to see more, hear more, read more about this guy.
So this is what more looks like. The Louis Armstrong collection is in a warren of offices and meeting rooms in the Rosenthal Library at Queens College on Long Island. The rooms are bland. Beige walls, green, low-pile carpet, only the whir of a central air conditioning system breaks the silence. But there's a homey feel to this place, made ever more so by the tall and friendly Riccardi and Armstrong's personal effects. As archivist, Riccardi has access to Armstrong's luggage, his books and correspondence, his record collection, and so many of the details that made up his life on the road and with his wife Lucille. Riccardi is all Armstrong all the time.
We are in the stacks of our archives, the research collections of the Louis Armstrong House Museum. A little bit of everything.
Oh, boy. Okay, and these are his books?
All the books found in the Armstrong House. I mean, some of them were by pretty famous authors. This is Famous American Negroes by Langston Hughes. And it is inscribed, especially for Louis Armstrong, with my admiration and high regard, Langston Hughes, April 3rd, 1954. In the most beautiful handwriting I've ever seen. So there's a connection that people don't make. Lewis never mentions Langston Hughes. Hughes never really mentions Armstrong. But we have three separate books from three separate dates inscribed from Hughes to Armstrong. So there's a relationship there that no one's really explored. We have the entire big band library. We have every arrangement that his big band played until they broke up in 47, 270 band parts. And all the later arrangements. What a wonderful world and all. We have all the parts, handwritten parts, typed parts, all of his music that you can imagine. Some sheet music. We have boxes of snapshots going back. I mean, Chicago, 1933. His adopted son, Clarence. Is the band relieving themselves in the side of the bus. He calls it tire inspection. But again, Armstrong, the archivist, is numbering every photo. 7, 8, 9, via green ink, telling future generations, this is the order. You know, all these photos belong together.
Riccardi is historian and sleuth, musician and fan. The two men, born 79 years apart, are simpatico because Riccardi, who's not yet 40, gets all of Armstrong's jokes.
Immediately, I found him so funny. I would hear the duets with Velma Middleton and laugh so hard.
Look here, honey. Look at that window there. You can't go out there in all that bad weather. I wouldn't think of letting you go out there. You're stupid of me to do that. You got the wrong window anyway. That a bay window there. See the one that's in the middle there? Halfway bolted up.
Yeah.
See that outhouse there? Ain't no use you going out there in all that bad weather, getting them two little skis all frostbitten and stuff.
Well, Pops, I didn't tell Mom and Papa where I was going.
You didn't what?
In fact, I sneaked out of the house.
Oh, Velma, don't never do that to your Mom and Papa. You know? You stay here 3 more days, and you go back home to your people then.
From the beginning, Armstrong's humor was vaudevillian, scatological, hipster. Just naughty enough to appeal to a 15-year-old boy, and just nice enough to appeal to his parents as well.
Take your shoes off, Lucy.
Oh, wait a minute now, wait.
And let's get juicy.
Yeah, later on, when I would read the critics who would just crucify him for showmanship and calling him a clown and all this stuff, I didn't come from that background at all, because I was coming from this love specifically for old comedies. And I just identified him. Oh, this is a guy with great comic timing. And then hear the trumpet and hear the voice. And I'm like, oh, he's just the greatest.
Riccardi told his friends about Armstrong. He co-founded a band that played some of Armstrong's music. He wrote about Armstrong in his college newspaper and won a statewide award in New Jersey for his first column, which concentrated on Armstrong's later years. That's a sweet spot for Riccardi, the time in Armstrong's professional life that since the age of 15, he's identified with the most.
It was the persona. And I think the Armstrong music that awoke in me was the music from the 1950s. The first recording that changed, the one that really changed my life after the Glenn Miller story, is I got a compilation called 16 Most Requested Songs. And it was all 1950s era Columbia recordings produced by George Avakian. It was everything. It was like the entire human experience coming out of this guy. And I just embraced all of it.
All to me, why not take all of me, babe? Yes, can't you see? I'm no good without you. Take my arms, I'll never use them. Take my lips. I wanna lose them. Baba to it. Your goodbye left me with eyes to cry. Oh, how can I go on, dear, without you? You took the fun that once was my heart. Why not take on you? Yes, I'm doing. Oh, can't you be better? I'm no good without you, man. Oh, take my lips, oh, baby. I'm no good without you, baby. Yes, you have your pops, so don't abuse them chops. So why not take all of them? I take it up, but all of it's your baronet.
Riccardi stands apart from other historians and music writers who are also experts on Armstrong. While most shy away from the later years, when Armstrong was a mainstream success and perhaps the most recognizable man in the world, Riccardi does the opposite. That's Louis Armstrong and the All-Stars with All of Me. Coming up, the history-changing record that Armstrong forgot he made. Stay with us. From Queens, New York, it's Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. This is Louis Armstrong with Canal Street Blues. The dates may be fuzzy, but most every music lover knows the story. At the turn of the last century, Louis Armstrong grew up in a rough and shady slice of New Orleans. People called his neighborhood the Battlefield. He sang for coins in a children's quartet. A petty crime or two landed him in a home for colored waifs. And there, Louis was exposed to his first formal music training. He got better and better, moved to Chicago, and then he got great. Add 10,000 bandstands and bippity-boppity-boo. Armstrong has the most recognizable face and voice in the world.
Grassa, 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 that's all right. Bella, 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 very nice. Yes, Donna, 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 you came by. Yeah, 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 yeah. Oh, Donna, bella, grassa. They can't have one no massa. For choco, sico, me. Yeah, choco, me.
Most music writers make a distinction between the Louis Armstrong of the 1920s, who made the virtuosic Hot 5 and Hot 7 recordings that changed jazz forever, and the Armstrong of later releases, Louis the Pop Star. As a mature artist, Armstrong played fewer of the high notes that had dazed and amazed his early fans. He sang more, and some of his bands were not so hot. But Armstrong's audiences worldwide kept growing and growing. Critics complained that he was selling out jazz for commercial appeal.
Oh, the shark has pretty teeth, dear. And he shows them a pearly white. Just a jackknife has Mac Heat, dear. And he keeps it out of sight. When the shark bites with his teeth, dear, scarlet billows.
reviews of Armstrong's shows could be withering. In the 1950s, The New Yorker called him both noble and past his peak. Canada's Globe and Mail called him a musical zombie. And Britain's Jazz Journal likened his act to blackface buffoonery. Ricky Riccardi is our guest. He directs research collections for the Louis Armstrong House Museum and wrote the book What a Wonderful World, The Magic of Louis Armstrong's Later Years. We're at his office at Queens College in Flushing, New York, sitting among Armstrong's papers and possessions. Riccardi respectfully disagrees with the conventional wisdom on Armstrong's career.
When you break Armstrong up into categories and eras and years and all that stuff, you're totally missing the boat. It's one guy, it's one genius, and everything is continuous, consistent, from New Orleans till death. Growing up as a kid, you know, he learns immediately the value of entertainment. He says the first time he ever really performed was in his mother's church. He delivered Burt Williams jokes, and he said the whole church started applauding. So he started impersonating the preacher, everything. Then he forms the vocal quartet, which is basically the foundation of everything he does musically. He was once asked how he improvises, and he said he goes right back to the quartet and trying to blend the voices together.
Regularly cites Armstrong's Hot 5 and Hot 7 recordings as the most important jazz records of the 20th century. But he also cautions that the general reverence for that music of the 1920s obscures some crucial facts.
So the Hot 5s and Hot 7s are records to make quick money. You know, they're not going in there to change history. They did. I will never say anything bad. I worship the Hot 5s and Hot 7s. But you know, it's 13, 14 days in Armstrong's life in a four-year period.
And even then, Riccardi says Armstrong was infusing his music with comedy, just as he'd always done when performing live.
All you have to do is listen to everything. You know, listen to the patter on King of the Zulus, or Tight Like This, or Lewis singing Irish Black Bottom, or playing the slide whistle on Who's It. You know, it's a much more rounded picture.
Oh, it's tight like this.
No, it ain't tight like that either.
I say it is tight like this.
Let it be tight like that then.
Then you dig deeper and start reading the newspaper reviews. And all the newspaper reviews of him in Chicago in the 20s are focusing on how funny he is. And, oh, the laugh riot. And he's singing. And he's dancing. And he's impersonating preachers. And he's doing Charleston acts. He's doing drag acts. So you take that now and you fast forward to the 50s. Okay, it's the same stuff. So, you know, if you want to say, oh, he didn't evolve, he didn't, you know, progress, he didn't get, well, yeah, that's a separate conversation.
And yet many of the compositions that the Hot 5 and Hot 7 recorded were no laughing matter. They navigated deep emotional waters and took unparalleled artistic flights. West End Blues, for instance, has stood for nearly 100 years among the finest recordings ever made. Armstrong blows like a tornado, and his ideas take off with unearthly speed and grace. It sounds like history being made, as significant as Neil Armstrong stepping onto the moon.
He never set out to do that. They literally forgot they made it.
Thank you.
the record came out, Earl Hines got it, and I said, whoa. And he went over to Lewis's house, and they loved it. They knew it was great. Most of the time, they were coming off, you know, working two jobs, and the session might be early hours in the morning or something, and, you know, some of it was material they were performing live. Some of that stuff was made up on the fly, but I would kill for a time machine, just for one night to hear what he was laying down at the Sunset Cafe or the Savoy or the Vendome. And I think if you got that total picture, that 1950s Armstrong wouldn't appear to be like this completely different guy.
When people went to see Armstrong perform in the 1920s, 30s, and even the 1940s, chances are his act would be the only entertainment of the night. No one went home to watch This Is Us or Game of Thrones or RuPaul's Drag Race or The Voice. Armstrong provided the drama, the visual razzmatazz, and the jokes. It all had to be there.
Everything, and especially for Armstrong. By the mid-30s, when Joe Glazer was hired as his manager, and he kind of builds him into this four-tiered superstar where Armstrong is a popular live attraction, popular on records, he's popular on the radio, and he's in movies. And I don't know if we could find anyone in jazz before or after who's got all four of those under his belt. He's performing every night. It wasn't just coming out and doing a jam session.
Armstrong later described his hands-on approach to performing on Voice of America. In concert, he rarely, if ever, left the stage.
When the band hit the first note, ever since I can remember, I hit it right with them. I see a lot of leaders let the band play a whole hour, and they come out for the grand ovation, and when they get out there, they don't do nothing. When that band hit that first one and that last one, I'm right there. And you take that from Satchmo.
Armstrong's showmanship continued offstage as well. Beginning in 1947, he made reel-to-reel tape recordings of his daily life. And man, was he entertaining. So were the people he socialized with, in dressing rooms, in hotel rooms, at dinner parties, and at home in Corona, Queens. On what may be the first tape Armstrong ever made, he and his friends tell dozens of jokes. Ever heard the one about the lion and the elephant? About the two boys and the lost dog? About the man with the insatiable wife? About the burglar in the hotel? About the rich woman kleptomaniac? About the four busiest hands in the world? Well, ask for tape number 1987.3.0111. Disc one, track one.
So long, everybody. Everybody out of so long. See, like Velma said, good night, all. And when I say it all, I mean all of you, brother.
Of course, most of the jokes on the tapes were not for family audiences. But Armstrong had plenty of funny innuendos in his act. Riccardi says humor served a practical necessity for the band. Take singer Velma Middleton. She weighed nearly 300 pounds, had terrific comedic timing, and often performed splits on stage.
But Armstrong first forms the All-Stars. Velma's not in the band for the first month. Velma comes in the band because Armstrong realizes it's a 2.5-hour concert. We have to break it up a little bit. So he becomes this master of how to pace a show. And there's a reason why his career continues to ascend in popularity while jazz in general starts struggling and starts to descend, you know.
And yet, by the late 1940s, bebop was on the rise. Bebop was not nearly as danceable as big band swing, nor was it intended to be. Those musicians and their compatriots in modern jazz often prized artistry over entertainment. To them, Armstrong's act was hokum. In his book about Armstrong's later years, Ricky Riccardi cites any number of complaints.
There was an interview from 1960 with John Lewis from the Modern Jazz Quartet. And John Lewis goes off on Armstrong. He goes, yeah, his band is so out. He goes, that's not for me. So the way he is jumping around, and he goes, that's not the way he really is. He goes, he's doing that to make the audience happy. He goes, it's fake. And, you know, it's just like, whoa. There's always been a part of me that like, wants to compile a list of these criticisms. But a lot of the top names of that period just hammered him.
Armstrong seemed befuddled by his critics. Here he is again speaking on Voice of America.
If you stand up there and play and don't smile or something, show that you're relaxing, then they call you your deadpan. I don't know. When they say that I play with musicians sometimes, that's not up to my standard. Well, I didn't know what my standard is. I mean, we were just taught how to, wasn't but two kind of music. Like Jack T. Gordon always said, there's only two kind of music, it's good or bad. And that's why you hear those hands when we finish playing our tunes, because we try to play them right.
Coming up, U.S. foreign policy set to music. Stay with us. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. Wouldn't it be nice if all diplomats could sing?
I'm the real ambassador. It is evident I was sent by government to take your place. All I do is play the blues and meet the people face to face. I'll explain and make it plain, I represent the human race, and don't pretend no more.
That's Louis Armstrong in 1961 singing a composition by Dave and Iola Brubeck. The Brubecks had him in mind when they wrote an entire show intended for Broadway called The Real Ambassadors. Armstrong had begun traveling overseas in the early 1930s, and in his later years, performed across Europe and Africa, in Brazil, Australia, and Japan. Occasionally, he represented the U.S. State Department as one of their international jazz ambassadors. So did other headliners, including Brubeck and Dizzy Gillespie. But as Armstrong and every other traveling musician knew, they were the ambassadors, with or without the Department of State.
Yeah, I remember when Diz was in Greece, back in 57. He did such a good job, we started sending jazz all over the world. The State Department has discovered jazz. It reaches folks like nothing ever has. Like when they feel that jazzy rhythm, they know we're really with them. That's what we call cultural exchange. Hirschwind gave the Muscovites a thrill. Weinstein was the darling of Brazil.
And isn't he here?
And just to stop internal mayhem, we dispatched Martha Graham. That's what we call cultural exchange. That's what we call cultural exchange.
But while the world loved Louis Armstrong, he faced increasing challenges on the home front. Ricky Riccardi directs research at the Louis Armstrong Archive here in Queens, New York. He says the height of Armstrong's fame coincided with an unpleasant rift in jazz.
Yeah, it was an ugly time. And it's kind of sad because this was coming off the period when jazz was America's popular music. And then these critics started, you know, you had the swing camp, you had the moldy fig camp, you had the bebop camp, and they're all fighting with each other. And the public just kind of said, all right, we're going to go over here and listen to Frank Sinatra and Louis Jordan and you know, let you guys settle your differences.
Aside from attacking Armstrong's persona on stage, detractors also questioned his taste in music. And Armstrong gave as good as he got. Remember the jazz critic Leonard Feather and his blindfold tests?
The blindfold test. With Leonard Feather.
Leonard Feather would get a musician and play him a bunch of records and not tell him what the records were or who they were and just write down his spontaneous reactions. He loved Armstrong, but he... really championed bebop and modern jazz, and he really helped cause, you know, the jazz wars. So he did two blindfold tests with Armstrong, one in 49 and one in 54. And he would always slip some modern jazz in there. And Armstrong never held back. And yeah, he never identified who it was. One of them was Charlie Parker and Miles Davis, and he just said, you know, nothing but variations. He goes, you know, no tone, you know, the drummer's messing up. I mean, he just really hammered them. And then they would play him a Guy Lombardo record, and he would say, ah, those are my inspirators, five stars, and all that stuff. And so the real hip jazz fans in the 50s, they would take one look at that and say, this is the most out of touch guy on the planet. But he never apologized for it.
Guy Lombardo, the popular Canadian orchestra leader, played violin and was known for sentimental music beckoning lovers to the dance floor. He and Armstrong once shared an extended engagement at New York's Jones Beach to record-breaking crowds.
I got mambo. I got jumbo. Every kind of mumbo jumbo that can be. I got a 5 cent mumbo for advice. 10 cent jumbo, that's my price. If you want mumbo jumbo, come to me.
In his blindfold test, Armstrong also gave top marks to young trumpet players Chet Baker, Ray Anthony, and Clark Terry. But the bad feeling between him and his critics ran deeper than arguing about music. Riccardi says Armstrong was stung in his later years by those questioning his bona fides as a black man. He was criticized in the black press for not marching for civil rights. Then he was criticized for demanding federal protection for the Little Rock Nine, young African-American students who in 1957 were trying to integrate a public school in Arkansas. Nasty crowds of white demonstrators were harassing them.
I was not alive back then, but how Armstrong could put his career on the line with Little Rock and say those things and blast the government and blast Eisenhower, and that doesn't change anything? You know, the criticisms keep on rolling in like it never happened. I mean, this was front page news, and he had Sammy Davis Jr. and Adam Clayton Powell and all these people coming out and criticizing him. Nobody in the jazz world saying, oh, I stand with Louis Armstrong. I mean, everybody hid. And so now Little Rock's become like this defining moment in Armstrong's life. But you can only imagine what was going on through his mind at the time. And I think it hurt him till the end.
Black audiences gradually left Armstrong for other delights, including R&B music. Armstrong understood when he played Houston in 1952 on the same night that Louis Jordan was playing. Riccardi says Jordan's audience was overwhelmingly black, and Armstrong's audience was overwhelmingly white.
Marty Napoleon, who lived through it, told me that story, and he was the piano player in the band. He went to the road manager, Frenchie, and said, you know, what happened? You know, why are there no black fans here? And the road manager goes, don't you know? He goes, the blacks hate him because they think he's Uncle Tom. And so Marty Napoleon was shocked by this.
And yet Armstrong's views on racial equality were obvious to anyone with eyes.
He's always appearing with the integrated band. So he's not worried so much about the makeup of the audience. He's worried about what he once said, the nice taste we leave.
Armstrong's refusal to budge on having an integrated band kept him out of his hometown for years. In New Orleans from 1956 until the passage of civil rights legislation in 1964, it was against the law for black and white musicians to play together on the same stage. Here's Armstrong talking with Leonard Feather about avoiding New Orleans.
We have two white boys in our band, so we play together everywhere else. We just have to put it down to somebody to see if it, you know. It'll stop, man. It'll be public demand to stop that. I see it coming.
And yet Armstrong's contributions to civil rights cannot be overstated. Riccardi remembers another appearance he made in Texas in 1931 at the old Driscoll Hotel in Austin. It was a segregated crowd, but there was a white teenager in attendance who needed to see that show.
Charles L. Black was raised to be racist, and he was just showing up at the stands to find some girls and get some action. Here's Louis Armstrong on stage. He had no idea. And he says it was the first time he ever encountered genius. And flash forward, and Charles L. Black, you know, ends up writing for Brown versus Board of Education, had his whole life change.
Black, who became a professor of constitutional law, helped shape the legal brief for the Brown case. After a celebration of the Supreme Court's decision to desegregate the schools, he went home and played Armstrong's 1927 recording of Savoy Blues. Ricardi says that race relations in New Orleans forever altered Armstrong's feelings about home. Civil rights legislation ended the ban on integrated musical acts, but in New Orleans, he routinely faced petty slights. Well into the 1960s, the city gave no official support to jazz. And despite the efforts of local jazz fans, developers knocked down his family home.
By far, Armstrong's years in New Orleans were the most important years of his life. And from the minute he pulled away on July 8, 22, to the minute he died, I don't think a day went by where he didn't spend part of the day singing about it, playing songs from New Orleans, talking about it, writing about it. But at the same time, the minute he left and went up north, he realized there was a whole another way of living. The way he put it once was he went up north. He said he got northernfied. He loved New Orleans, but he definitely moved on.
Your face beams in my dreams. In spite of all I do, oh baby, everything seems to ring. Memories of you.
I do think if you would have told him, you know, one day the airport's going to be named after you and all, I don't think he would have seen that coming, you know. I think that would have probably been a pretty big surprise considering you tearing down his house and, you know, not publicizing jazz and not bringing him down and all that. And one day he's got an airport, he's got a festival, he's got T-shirts in every block and things, a park and a statue, and things change.
When Armstrong died in 1971, 25,000 people paid their respects at the New York National Guard Armory. And all these years later, New York still celebrates him. In Queens, the Armstrong House Museum is expanding across the street and will house the research collection that our guest, Ricky Ricardi, heads. In Flushing Meadows Corona Park, the U.S. Open Tennis Championships now have a Louis Armstrong Stadium. In Manhattan, on Wednesday nights, the jazz club Birdland features David Oswald, leading the Louis Armstrong Eternity Band. And in Midtown, maybe one of Armstrong's greatest fans yet. The Algonquin Hotel has long attracted the creative elite, top writers and artists and performers. We met George Lugo there by the happiest of accidents. Of all the gin joints in all the world, Lugo was our waiter at the hotel lounge. Turns out he's been listening to Armstrong for nearly 50 years.
I mean, I love swing. Swing is like my heart, you know. I love it because it's so beautiful. It's full of joy, sadness, the blues, everything. The daddy of swing is Louis Armstrong.
On a series of hotel postcards, now photographed on our website, Lugo wrote a list of his all-time favorite jazz compositions. West End Blues is at the top. And his next favorite Armstrong recording is Weatherbird from 1928, which features Earl Hines on piano. Weatherbird may not have been the first recorded jazz duet, but it was the first to blow everybody's ears back.
Mm-hmm.
I've always liked the best of everything. So when I heard that, I said, this is the best.
Take the 7 train back to Queens, and our guest, Ricky Riccardi, has a totally different list, as would any Armstrong fan.
So Lincoln Center asked me to do a top 10 for Spotify, and I struggled with this for so many weeks and got them to do 20.
Riccardi is working on yet another book about Armstrong, this time concentrating on his middle years. But he's still partial to the mature artist, whose songs he heard as a boy growing up in Toms River, New Jersey. Riccardi encourages the curious to look for that Lewis online, where he's uploaded and found any number of videos, because Armstrong is endlessly interesting.
Armstrong was the world's greatest duet partner, and for a duet that you might not think works, look up Lewis and Johnny Cash. It's on Johnny Cash's TV show in October 1970, and they do Blue Yodel No. 9. And it's less than a year before Armstrong died. He had been off the scene. Doctors told him to stop performing, but he had this last hurrah, and he's on TV, and he's playing beautifully and looking great, and it's beautiful.
Ricky Riccardi, oh, man. You're a doll.
Right back at you.
Ricky Riccardi is the director of research at the Lewis Armstrong Collection at Queens College. We spoke with him at his office in Flushing.
We did a little research on some of your recordings. We find that on July 16th, 1930, you played trumpet on a session with the late Jimmy Rogers, the father of country music.
I sure did.
That was in Hollywood, right?
That's right. So I've been knowing Jimmy for a long time and following up his music too. And I have a meet one morning and Jimmy said, man, I feel like singing some blues, you know? Mm-hmm. I said, okay, Daddy, you sing some blues and I'm gonna blow behind you. And that's the way the record started, you know?
You know what I would love to do? I would like to kind of recreate that recording session of July 16th, 1930. We'll get Bill Walker to play piano, and I'll try to sing Jimmy Rogers' lyrics, this lyrics he recorded, and you wail like you did on the record. Can we do that?
Well, that's what they do. We'll say, we give it to him in black and white.
Okay. Yeah. She come into the joint with a 44 gun in each hand and said, "Now stand aside there, I'm looking for my man." I hid in the back and I stood up there and I said,
you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Ethel Ozen, Flawn Williams, Garrett Pittman, Justin Armstrong, and Lars Howell. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. For more information about Ricky Riccardi and the Louis Armstrong House Museum, go to our website at musicinsideout.org. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the historic New Orleans collection. Music Inside Out also receives support from the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, the Rosa Mary Foundation, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, Adam Newman Studio, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax deductible thanks to our partnership with the National Performance Network. For more information on how you can support our program, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.